Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Today we're covering true crime, and we'll be covering a really surprising story from an excellent book I've just been listening to. It's called The Lazarus Files, and it's a cold case investigation. Came out in April of this year, and joining me today is the author of the book, researcher, Matthew McGough. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Now, Matt, now how did you get into doing this? This is a really complex, interesting case, cold case that's lasted for years. What got you into this case? How did you find it?
Well, my journey investigating this cold case began about 10 years ago. The person who committed the murder was an LAPD detective named Stephanie Lazarus, and it was a cold case in that she was not arrested until 2009, but the crime occurred in February of 1986, about 23 years earlier. And it was actually a coincidental meeting that I had with Stephanie Lazarus, the guilty party, about a year before she was arrested that sparked my interest in the case. So I actually interviewed her about her about art theft, which was her last detective assignment before she was arrested, thinking that I was going to write a book about art theft. And then it was about a year after our initial conversation that she was arrested for murder. So that really obviously threw me for a loop, that this veteran female LAPD detective who I sat down with and talked with about art and art theft, was suddenly accused of having committed a horrific murder almost a quarter century earlier. So obviously had a lot of questions, and that's what set me down this road that led to writing this book.
So when you started going through and getting the information and meeting people and writing the book and all that, how did you find the reaction of people that were close to the case?
Well, it's been an ongoing process. Like I said, I really sort of fell down the rabbit hole in June 2009, which was when Stephanie was arrested, and started going down to court for her arraignment and subsequent court proceedings. She went to trial in 2012, so it was about a 3-year period that the case was sort of winding its way through court. And it was through that experience going to court that I got to know many of the people who had been affected by this tragedy. You know, most significantly, the family of the victim, Sherry Rasmussen, her parents also attended all of the court hearings. Because Stephanie was a LAPD officer, there was quite a, you know, there was, it was a high profile, high priority case for the LAPD, given the circumstances of the crime. And so I also got to know a lot of law enforcement personnel, the detectives who were assigned to the case, detectives who worked in the LAPD's cold case homicide unit, and others. And so it was more of a process than sort of all the information coming out at one time. But it was a combination of following the court case very, very closely, and then getting to know people who were actually in the story, that I developed all the information that eventually ended up in the book.
So when you met her and you were talking with her, what did you think of her? Like, was it a real surprise to find out that she was involved in a murder, or were you sort of, what kind of feeling did you get about her?
No, I was completely shocked. She was very cordial. Stephanie had a good reputation as a detective. I mean, it's sort of surprising, looking back, why someone who was harboring a secret like that, literally having committed a murder 20 some years earlier and continuing to work as a police officer the entire time, you know, why she would have granted an interview with a journalist like myself, but she did. It was a cordial conversation. In my memory, the most, you know, vivid thing about it is, again, that I interviewed her inside LAPD headquarters. So I certainly, you know, was not on the lookout for homicide suspects when I was sitting across from her and her partner. The interview itself wasn't all that memorable, but, you know, it was an interesting thing to talk with a detective about her work, like I said, inside police headquarters. So it was about a year later when the news broke that she had been arrested that suddenly cast that earlier conversation in a very different light.
Now, she still denies doing it, right? Like, she hasn't admitted to it.
No, she's never taken responsibility for the crime. She did not testify during her trial. She did not make any statement at all, let alone express any remorse or anything prior to her sentencing. So, in fact, Stephanie has made no public statements at all since the day that she was arrested in June 2009. And I reached out to her in prison a couple of times, requesting interviews prior, before I finished the book. She did not respond, which obviously is her prerogative. But there was quite a lot of information that came in about her during the trial, and I was able to interview many of her former colleagues, friends, and family members. That's how I was able to fill in as much as I could about her perspective.
Now, how was that perceived by her family? Did her friends and colleagues, people that worked with her in the police department, and any family or anything like that, did they support her and believe she was innocent, or were they kind of not sure, or they were totally thought she did it?
Well, you know, there's there's 10,000, you know, officers on the LAPD, so it's very hard, obviously, to generalize in terms of what everyone believed. But, you know, certainly, I would say for the vast majority of, you know, the police officers, as the evidence came out, there was quite a lot of circumstantial and also direct evidence that Stephanie had committed the murder. She had a motive. There was DNA, her DNA that was at the crime scene. So I think for most people, that evidence removed any doubt that they had about whether or not this might have been a mistake that she would have been called to answer for committing this crime. You know, with her family, I think it's a little bit more complicated. Stephanie now is divorced, but at the time of her arrest, she was married to a fellow LAPD officer, a fellow LAPD detective. He attended most of her trial, and, you know, their marriage did not end until after she was convicted. So I do think for some of her family members, it was harder to accept that she may, in fact, have done this. And, you know, again, this whole story unfolded over time. So I would say probably at the time that she was arrested, there were a lot of doubts. And then over the course of the criminal case and more evidence is introduced, I think a lot of those doubts fell away for a lot of people. But to this day, as I said, she hasn't admitted her guilt, and it's I think a difficult situation for her family members. Stephanie was probably the most accomplished member of her family in terms of being a longtime police detective, and so there's quite a big distance between where she was the day before she was arrested and how she was perceived within her family, and then for that all to come crashing down, you know, in the span of one morning when she was arrested, I think probably created a lot of cognitive dissonance for people who were close to her.
Yeah, I just wonder if do you think she's ever committed other crimes since the 1986 murder until she was arrested? That's a long period. So do you think she was involved in other crimes, or this was just kind of...
I did not find any evidence of anything close to, you know, I don't think that she's hiding another murder. Didn't find any evidence or anything to suggest that. But obviously, you know, this is the most serious crime that someone can commit. So, you know, it's not as if, she would need a second crime for it to, be of concern. But no, I mean, generally, I think her career as a officer and as a detective was on some level fairly unremarkable, in that she, I don't think she was, you know, like, I don't think she faced, like her record wasn't littered with other disciplinary infractions or things like that. The more interesting, let alone crimes, in terms of her record as an officer, for me, the more interesting aspect of her career, rather than things that she, rules that she may have broken or any other crimes that she may have committed, is just how many different sensitive assignments she worked as a police officer. She made detective. She later worked in internal affairs. She worked performing background checks of civilian applicants to the LAPD. She worked homicide at Van Nuys Homicide, where the case, the murder that she had committed, was still an open case. several other assignments before she, you know, eventually reached the art that detail, which is how I met her.
Now, did you think that at the time of the murder, was there any chance that she would be suspected?
Yeah, she certainly was suspected by several of the family members and friends of Sherry Rasmussen. Stephanie was romantically involved with the husband of the victim, Sherry. Sherry's husband, John, had been a college classmate of Stephanie at UCLA, and their relationship was somewhere between friendship and a romantic relationship, sort of an on-and-off-again relationship is how it's been described. And that continued from college, which was in the late 70s, early 80s, until about 1984, which was when John met Sherry Rasmussen, who would become his wife. And it was that dynamic of a love triangle that ultimately precipitated the murder.
So were they still seeing each other or having an affair, as people would call it, after John got married?
Yeah, again, the listeners can, you know, hopefully, you know, well, they can find more details and dates about this within the book. But yeah, there, you know, as more details came out during the trial, it became apparent that the romantic relationship between John and Stephanie did not have a clean break, and that in fact John and Stephanie had gotten together during his engagement to Sherry, and then in fact several years after the murder committed. Now, John was told by the detectives back in 86 that Stephanie had been investigated and eliminated as a suspect, so according to him, he believed that she had nothing to do with Sherry's murder. But nevertheless, John and Stephanie reconnected in the early 90s and resumed their relationship at that time. So that's sort of a difficult thing to wrap your head around, that he, in fact, had sex with his wife's killer unwittingly, in terms of not knowing that she had committed that horrific crime several years after the murder.
So you think that John is pretty clear he wasn't involved or he didn't know about it?
Well, John was, again, there's plenty of ambiguity in the story, and there's lots of points in the story where different people are saying different things, and it's hard, if not impossible, to arbitrate 100% who is telling the truth and who's not. My strategy for dealing with that was to interview as many people as I could and to present the information as objectively as possible. Everything in the book is based on either interviews I conducted myself or sworn testimony that was given on the witness stand or interviews or statements that were given to the LAPD. So I tried to be very careful with my sourcing and present where I was getting the information from. But yeah, John was quite clear on the witness stand and in various interviews he gave with the police that he provided Stephanie's name and the fact that she was a police officer to the detectives investigating the murder the day after Sherry was killed.
So what do you think when you were doing the research and involved in writing the book, what was the biggest surprise or the biggest shock to you during that process?
Well, the day Stephanie was arrested was a pretty big shock, obviously, just because, again, I had met this woman, had a cordial conversation with her, lasted more than an hour, exchanged business cards, and then to find out that she was stood accused of committing a horrific murder so many years earlier. And had not only possibly gotten away with it, but had been a police officer that entire time. That would probably rank as the biggest shock throughout this experience of researching and writing this book. But there were many others, and it's been sort of a journey and process of learning and discovering more all the way along. So there were a lot of things that I didn't know about how cold cases are investigated, the history of the LAPD's cold case unit, how it is that different cold cases are prioritized, how this case was solved, and so many different wrinkles, policies, procedures, different perspectives of people in the story. I mean, there's the surprises are
endless,
you know, endless. Yeah. And continuing, I feel like I, even since the book has been out over the last few weeks, I've been hearing from quite a few people who, either worked with Stephanie over the years or, have their own, perspectives or experiences that they've shared. And that's new information to me. Maybe if I get to revise the book when there's a paperback edition, I'll be able to fold some of that new info in. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of crazy. Even 10 years into digging into this story, I'm still learning new details. It feels like almost every day.
Yeah. So do we know why she committed this crime? I mean, if she's denying it, not admitting it, you're not getting it from her. And I guess the obvious thing would be because John had married this Sherry Rasmussen. So, I mean, that would be kind of the guesswork I would have. Do you think that's why she did this?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear what the interpersonal dynamics were leading up to the murder, in that it was a love triangle and that Stephanie had a broken heart. One of the pieces of evidence that came in during the trial, which I quote from quite a bit in the book, is a diary that Stephanie actually kept back in the mid-1980s. At the time the murder was committed, Stephanie was a LAPD patrol officer. She had joined the LAPD in 1983, so had about 3 years on the job, and she had a practice of keeping a diary of her activities on duty. Whenever she worked, she sort of wrote down a narrative of who her partner was, what she had done on duty that day. So I had a pretty remarkable record of what she had been up to on the job and in her own voice from about 12 to 18 months prior to the murder, running through the day of the murder, and then about 6 months afterwards. So that information sort of helped make clear the degree to which Stephanie felt left behind, heartbroken by the fact that John had met someone else and had decided to marry her. And I think that was something that built inside of Stephanie, you know, right up until the day of the murder. And it's clear, you know, also other conversations that Stephanie had with friends where she confessed her heartbreak to them, that you know, that there not only was there direct evidence, but you know, there was quite a bit of circumstantial evidence in terms of her motive to support why she did this.
Well, you know, you mentioned how, okay, so you know, it's a triangle relationship, and she was heartbroken that John had married Sherry, and so in essence that's what we're kind of suggesting is why she killed Sherry. And then you say that the two of them, John and Stephanie, hooked back up after the murder was committed, like down the road. Did John and Stephanie end up married, or did they end up together then? Like, or if not, how come?
Well, they never married, and like I said, the relationship is a bit ambiguous. You know, it's a phrase that people use today that say that, you know, somebody's friends with benefits. I don't know if that was that phrase had been coined yet at the time these events were unfolding in the 1980s, but it seems like it was sort of a very close friendship that had a sexual component that, you know, sort of ran through the relationship, but you know, they were never boyfriend girlfriend, or at least John never considered them boyfriend girlfriend. Friends of theirs did not see them as boyfriend girlfriend, but for many years in their, you know, during the college years and the years after college, they were for stretches sort of inseparable and best friends, and that continued until John met Sherry. And then after her murder, according to John, this is what he said on the witness stand, they were not.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Not in contact for some time. He had been told by the detective that Stephanie was not involved in the murder, and so I think, again, according to John, that's what he believed to be true. And then it was a couple years after that that they reconnected. John admitted on the witness stand that the romantic relationship resumed in the early 90s. Probably 5 or 6 years after the murder. And then a year or two after that, coincidentally, both John and Stephanie met other people who they would eventually marry. So by the mid-90s, Stephanie is married to the fellow police officer who she stayed with through the end of her arrest. And John had also remarried to a woman with whom he started a family and remains married to today.
Yeah, I see that, but I just find that strange, because in her mind, if she actually went out and killed this Sherry because she felt, you know, Sherry was taking John away from her, and she wanted more of him or wanted to be around him more, you would think after the murder she would work at getting back together with him.
Yeah, again, it is, I would agree with you. It is strange, and it's hard to know exactly what was going on inside that relationship, what John may have suspected, but was unwilling to admit, maybe even to himself. There were certainly a lot of people around Sherry, particularly her parents and her girlfriends, to whom she had confided a series of troubling incidents involving John's ex-girlfriend. Sherry felt like she was being followed. Stephanie once came to Sherry's workplace and confronted her in her office, said something like, if I can't have John, no one can. And Sherry felt, I think, quite, somewhere on the spectrum between, threatened, harassed, annoyed by this ex-girlfriend of John enough that she told her parents and close girlfriends about it prior to her murder. And quite a bit of that information was communicated to the detectives investigating the case, but none of that information was documented in the police records, and these are things that ended up having, the passage of time only compounded the mistakes that were made early in the investigation.
What do you hope people get out of the book? Like, what do you want? Is there a story that you want them to get, or some sort of meaning? What would be your thought on what?
Well, I guess the reason that it what sustained me the entire time I was working on it, because again, I didn't know what I was in for when I started working on this. If you go back to my explanation of how this all started, I sat down with this police detective and interviewed her about art theft, and then a year later I found out that she had been arrested for murder. So that was a pretty good hook and a pretty interesting story to get into it. What I didn't realize at the beginning, and what became more important to me over time, was understanding how the police department works, how these cases are investigated, and where the mistakes may have been made in this case. I mean, I think you don't get more serious crime than murder. The fact that a police officer committed a murder, got away with it for so many years, that's obviously a really grave failure institutionally on the part of the LAPD. And when Stephanie was arrested, the parents of the victim, Nels and Loretta Rasmussen, they gave a press conference where they intimated that although they were happy with the LAPD of 2009 and the job they had done bringing Stephanie to justice, they had very serious questions and concerns about what had been done in 1986 and whether there had been a cover-up based on Stephanie's status as a police officer and the information that had been provided to the detectives back in 86. And the family felt as though the investigation may have been steered away from Stephanie because she was a police officer. And the LAPD promised an investigation into what went wrong, but as time passed, and again, I was sort of investigating what had happened myself at the same time that the LAPD had claimed to be doing its own investigation, but pretty much none of the people who I spoke with involved in the case had been contacted by the LAPD. And after a few years, when Stephanie was convicted, the LAPD announced that their investigation had found no evidence of a cover-up. But I questioned how the department could know that when they hadn't interviewed anyone, apparently. Because again, if they had been doing a thorough investigation of what went wrong, I would have expected that we would have been interviewing the same people. Instead, it seemed as if I was the only one who was interviewing anyone, even while the department was claiming publicly that the Rasmussen's accusation had been investigated, and the department had you know, determine that there was no intentional cover-up. So, again, for there to be a failure as serious as missing a murderer in their midst for more than 20 years, especially when, you know, the family is claiming that they identified the killer to the detectives directly the day after the murder in 1986, you know, that should not happen, and it should not be. And if you're going to have an institutional failure as grave as this one, I think it's incumbent on the institution to draw some lessons, identify what the mistakes were, you know, so that nothing like this could ever happen again. So I think that desire for, you know, the full truth and accountability, I think accountability is a goal that, again, it's not in my control. That has to come from inside the LAPD. But yeah, it was clear that, you know, this was a serious failure, and I wanted to do as thorough an investigation as I was capable of to get the facts on the table and, hopefully, set up the conditions such that something like this is less likely to happen in the future, ever again.
So you're thinking that the actual 1986 investigation was more of a failure than a cover-up?
Well, you know, I sort of avoid labels, right, in the book. I mean, I wanted, yeah, to sort of show, not tell, and, again, try to present information objectively rather than judgmentally. So I don't, you know, you won't find sort of a sentence summing up this was a cover-up or not a cover-up. Again, what I learned and sort of focused on was, you know, the policies and procedures that detectives follow and are supposed to follow when they investigate a homicide. There's obviously a lot of cases, a lot of different detectives, personal styles, writing styles. There's so many variables for any homicide case that's being worked. But there are best practices that have developed over the years. And what became clear to me as I dug deeper into this case was that some of the biggest missed opportunities, chances where the case could have been resolved much sooner than it was, those sort of lined up with the times that, you know, policies and procedures were not followed. And so it was interesting to me to sort of see what the, you know, what the risks and dangers are of disregarding, you know, standard policies and procedures, and what can go wrong as a result of that, you know, years down the road. So, yeah, I would say a failure without question. I mean, Stephanie was guilty of murder, and it, you know, did not get arrested for 23 years after the murder and worked as a cop that whole time. I think that, you know, by anyone's measure would be a pretty serious institutional failure. In terms of whether there was a cover-up, again, I think there's evidence of avoidance. You know, I think, again, previously, before I started digging into this, I would have, you know, I'm not sure what I would have looked for as like the hallmark or conclusive proof that something had been covered up. Over the course of investigating this, it's become apparent to me that, you know, sometimes what people call a cover-up can be evidence, you know, there's like a red flag, something that should be investigated, that is, something's obviously wrong. But instead of it being investigated, there's like, you know, it's the lack of action. It's when something calls out for action and nothing happens, that is sort of troubling and insidious. So, it, you know, a cover-up is not necessarily an active act. It can be looking away when there's something that seems like it should have warranted action.
Hmm. Now she got convicted eventually. Is that right?
Yes, Stephanie was convicted of first-degree murder, so she's now serving a sentence of 27 years to life.
And is she appealing that, or is that...
Yeah, she's filed numerous appeals, all of which have been denied to date. Again, obviously it's her right. She can appeal it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But, based on my experience, attending the trial and observing all the evidence and testimony, I don't think she's a very good candidate for appeal. But obviously she has the right to appeal. And to this day, she's never taken any sort of responsibility or expressed remorse. And, to be a good candidate for parole, you would have to take responsibility. So,
yeah.
As things stand today, I think she'll be in prison for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a long, long while, probably.
I just
wonder. It must be just as tough for a female police officer in prison as a male.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, I really hoped to interview Stephanie for the book, and never got that opportunity. So yeah, I have my own questions about what it's like for her inside. Anecdotally, I heard that she declined any sort of, I think there can be high risk. Inmates can be segregated for their protection or for other reasons from others. But I heard anecdotally that Stephanie declined that. So she's apparently in with the general population, which is apparently something that she chose. But there's only a handful of women's prisons in California. I think three total. So it's a smaller number of prisons. She's moved around a few times. That's what I know about that.
Hmm. During the trial, how did she appear? Like, was she, aggressive? I mean, I know she didn't testify, but when she was sitting with her counsel and stuff during the trial,
not aggressive.
No,
very, I would say stone-faced is the adjective I would use. She only really smiled when she would enter and leave the courtroom. She would look towards her family members, her mom, her brother attended much of the trial, her husband at that time. She would sort of, exchange greetings with them as she made her way to the defense table. But while court was in session, she was very, she would pay attention, but did not, display any emotion, which again is just one of the interesting things about the case and her personality. You know, this murder, obviously it was part of a love triangle. It was, a crime inspired by her heartbreak and sort of a loss of control, that she would have been so, hurt by John's rejection of her that she would lash out in this way, so over the top, so out of bounds, and lose control of her emotions to kill someone. And contrasting that loss of control with sort of the discipline and the lack of emotion that she displayed at the trial was striking, and remains a mystery to me how someone can be capable of losing it, and also, keeping it together. I mean, the trial must have been very difficult for her emotionally, just in terms of, again, everyone or most people have had their heart broken at one time or another through their life. I mean, imagine reliving the worst breakup you ever had publicly in front of all of your family members, friends. I imagine some days of the trial were extraordinarily humiliating and painful for her, but she never showed any emotion during any of those moments, even when it was detailing, you know, her extreme heartbreak back in the 1980s, even when it was John Rudden on the witness stand explaining, again, in front of the jury, the public, strangers, Sherry's family, Stephanie's family, that, you know, he never loved her, that he never intended to marry her, you know, things like that, you know, must have been painful for her to hear, but she didn't really show it on her face.
Now, the current husband, now, did he divorce her then after she was convicted?
Yes. After her conviction, he filed for divorce. Yeah. And as far as I know, he remains an LAPD officer. So again, this was like a very complicated, painful case politically within the LAPD. Not only had Stephanie been an LAPD officer for a long time and had 20 some years worth of, you know, professional and personal relationships she developed on the job, but, her husband was LAPD. They had not met and married until several years after the murder. So I certainly consider him a victim in this as well. Again, you can imagine marrying someone in your 30s, and then, you know, this awful revelation that she had committed a murder before they even met, you know, must have been very painful for him to come to terms with.
Now, did they have kids?
Yeah, they adopted a little girl in around 2006, so a few years before Stephanie was arrested.
I imagine that's really hard on the family then, like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine so. Again, one of my sources, one of the detectives who worked the case, it's something that he said to me once that has sort of stayed with me the whole time, that, you know, again, the tragic event was back in 1986, but it reverberates over time, and it's really mind-boggling to think about the ripple effect and the number of lives that this has affected, you know, year after year after year. People who, again, didn't even know Stephanie back when the crime occurred, or like her daughter, weren't even alive when the crime occurred, but what happened and the revelations about what happened, you know, changed the course of countless lives over time.
Wow. So how did you get a chance to talk to her parents or her mother or her family like that?
No, I spoke to Stephanie's brother, Stephen, you know, which was interesting to hear a little bit more about, you know, their upbringing. But yeah, I mean, again, I requested interviews from, you know, pretty much everyone, but couldn't force people to come to the table. So, you know, the most significant characters in the story who I was not able to talk to were, I would say, probably Stephanie and John. But in both cases, you know, I was able to use other methods of reporting, statements that they had given, or interviews with people who knew them at the time, and tried to fill in as much of the story as I could that way, even though I couldn't speak to them myself.
So what have you got planned next after, now that you finished this book? Where do you plan on going?
Well, I have an idea for, you know, there was one of the LAPD's cold case detectives, a guy named Rick Jackson, who's a pretty remarkable person. He's now retired, but had a fascinating career solving homicide cases for the LAPD. He solved a case back in the early 90s that he thought would always make a great book, but he's not a writer. He asked me whether I'd be interested in writing it with him, and I think that sounds pretty fun. So, you know, it'll probably be a couple of years before that's out, but you can stay tuned for another true story of LAPD homicide detectives. Hopefully not too long.
Wow. Now, do you have a website or a place that people can reach you?
Yes, I do. I have an author website, which can be reached either by visiting MatthewMcGough.com, or if it's easier to spell, you can just go to thelazarusfiles.com, files, plural, and that'll bring you both to the same place. And I put quite a bit of information up there, background information, other things that I've written about the case, interviews like this one that we're recording right now. I'll probably post this on the website when I get a recording. And yeah, there's quite a bit of info there for people who want to hear more, learn more about the case, to poke around among.
Great. Now, your book is available, of course, on Amazon and I guess most bookstores, and it's...
And also, yeah, at yes, I love local independent bookstores, so, yeah, people can find it locally and also online.
Fantastic. We'll have that on our website as well, so people listening can just do one click and pick up the book. Wow. Well, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation, incredible book, and you read the book as well, don't you, like on the audio?
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. I was asked to do that. I didn't know exactly what I was in for. I mean, the book is quite lengthy, and it ended up, I thought it was going to be a couple of days to read this thing for the audiobook. It ended up taking more than 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, something like 27 hours long. So
yeah,
anybody who has a long commute or cross-country drive or something like that, hopefully they'll check it out.
Yeah, that's the way to go. That's the way I go now. That's all I do.
Yeah, it was a good experience reading it. It was very interesting. I'm glad that that's out there and in my own voice.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of work. Well, it's been interesting. Thank you very much for taking the time to be on.
Thank you
show.
So much, Al. This was really a pleasure.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.